KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today I'm very excited to have on another of the Princeton guests that I had on as part of my promise to Hearsay Culture listeners when I began this visitorship and spending as much time as I can up at Princeton. I wanted to bring on the array of fascinating scholars working in areas that are all directly related to the topics that Hearsay Culture covers. And so I've interviewed over the last year Ed Felton and Lisa Lynch and Solomon Barocas and others. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Arvind Narayanan, who's an assistant professor of computer science at Princeton, who focuses on information privacy and security, and technology policy. CITP is an amazing and very almost unique organization in academia in that it focuses heavily on how you can translate science to the policy world. And so all of the people involved at CITP, coming from very interesting backgrounds in computer science and elsewhere, people that understand technology and that write about technology and that do the kind of work that needs to be done in order to build systems and understand systems, are also very interested in seeing that that work be translatable and used in the policy arena. And Arvind is certainly no exception to that. Today we're going to be focusing on a couple of major topics, bitcoins, which is a focus of CITP, and also crypto and privacy. Now, if you go to Arvind's website, which you can find at randomwalker.info, he identifies three primary focuses in his research. First being web privacy, and particularly the Web Transparency and Accountability Project, where I've seen a couple of presentations, and there was a conference at CITP, I believe this past October, focusing on issues like privacy in surfing the net and issues like how do not track the government's effort to attempt to protect consumers from really secret behavior on the part of web hosts and web actors. What we used to call spyware, but I think has moved beyond that, is a primary focus here, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. We are going to focus, however, more heavily on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, another topic of focus in Arvind's work, and we're going to spend a good amount of time working through Bitcoin, why it's important beyond the world of currency, why Princeton has a course in that area, and what it means. And lastly, a third focus, primary focus of Arvind's work, focuses on big data, particularly anonymity, privacy, and ethics. This is a fascinating area that I think we'll talk about as well, all of which running through this world of cryptography and what that means. One of the interesting and really, I think, somewhat disturbing areas within the world of crypto as well as data is this question of what it means to be anonymous. This past week, we heard and I interviewed Gabriella Coleman on her work involving and her book involving the hacker group Anonymous, which of course draws on this notion of anonymity, which sounds great in theory, but which is often very difficult to apply in practice. And so there is, and Arvind's focus has been, how data, which is otherwise believed to be anonymous or which otherwise is not supposed to be able to allow for one to identify an individual, becomes de-anonymized. And so throughout Arvind's work, there is this theme of privacy, which we are going to talk about as well today. By way of brief background, as I mentioned, Arvind Narayanan is an assistant professor of computer science at Princeton. He is a faculty member at CITP. He is also, along with me, an affiliate scholar at Stanford's Center for Internet and Society. He was a postdoctoral researcher at Stanford and got his PhD at University of Texas at Austin. He blogs not only at randomwalker.info, but also at Freedom to Tinker and at 33 Bits of Entropy. He has a Twitter account. He is joining us via Skype from his office at Princeton. We are recording on May 19th, 2015. Arvind, thank you so much for joining us in Hearsay Culture.
Thank you, Dave. It's wonderful to be on the show, and I do miss the sunny Palo Alto weather from my years as a postdoc at Stanford. The East Coast is certainly a bit colder and rainier.
Yes, you know, I feel the exact same way. I remember going out there for the first time in 2005 and just wondering why people were smiling so much, particularly as a New Yorker. And then I realized a lot of it was because of the weather. I share that with you. Arvid, I mentioned your background in a little bit, but I always ask my guests, tell us a bit more about your background and really how you became the focus. How you came to focus on bitcoins and cryptography and privacy?
Certainly. I started out during my PhD at the University of Texas doing sort of more mathematical, more cryptographic types of research, at first simply because it was just so intellectually interesting to me. And then I gradually started focusing more on the applications of cryptography to privacy, and then my interest focused more on privacy itself, regardless of the methods that are used to achieve it. And in fact, in some of my more recent work, I've become somewhat skeptical about exactly how much crypto can help protect our privacy as opposed to a variety of other techniques. And that's something I'd love to chat about with you and our listeners as well. In terms of Bitcoin, though, the way I got into it was in a manner that's, I think, at least to me, fairly amusing, and hopefully to people who are listening, which is that when I was in grad school, I wasn't sure what I wanted as a career, but the one thing I didn't want was academia. I was sure I didn't want to become an academic, didn't want to become a professor. And a big part of the reason for that was because I wasn't too thrilled with the in sort of a quote-unquote ivory tower way in which academic research was done, a bit removed from the real world, and people going off on long stretches of uninterrupted thinking instead of a more active, collaborative sort of way in which the open source community, for example, functioned. But, you know, for reasons that that are long and circuitous and you know, it took many years, I gradually revised that decision. But having been an academic, I was still very, very fascinated with that open source way of doing research and wanted an opportunity to try that. And when Bitcoin came along, seeing that it originated outside academia and was being developed by this community of people collaborating on forums and blogs and so on, I was completely thrilled by it. And I thought, you know, this could be the wave of research in the future, where this process for research, where there's no gatekeeping and anybody can contribute an idea in an online post, could lead to a science advancing at a much more rapid pace than the way that academics were doing it. So that was a big part of my motivation for wanting to do research on Bitcoin. And of course, you know, it also brought together some of my expertise in crypto and my interest in privacy, and was very intellectually interesting. But a big part of the reason for that was because I wanted to try this new process of doing research.
So, Arvind, just before we talk about Bitcoins, I do want to make sure for listeners that don't focus heavily on it, when we say the word cryptography, what do we mean by it from a computer science perspective? What is cryptography?
Sure. Cryptography, from a computer science perspective, has a variety of applications, and the one that's by far, I think, the most familiar to us is encryption, where two people across the internet can send a message with, to each other with the basically the mathematical guarantee that nobody else is able to read that message, even if they intercept it. Because it's encrypted, they will not be able to decipher the plain text. And that mathematical guarantee stems from the fact that nobody else except these two people have knowledge of what one calls a secret key. So that's the most well-known application of cryptography for encryption. You know, it even shares the same word root. However, there are many other interesting applications of cryptography. And one is called authentication. And what's involved here is something called digital signatures. And digital signatures also come from the same principle of having these secret keys and public keys corresponding to those secret keys. And that's actually what Bitcoin uses. There's no encryption in Bitcoin. per se. Instead, what happens in Bitcoin is a system by which people can authenticate messages as coming from them in a way that cannot be forged by anybody else. And that is the fundamental mathematical security property that allows you to have an online currency system. That's what allows you to assert that you are the owner of a certain number of bitcoins, which represent, you know, some value in the economy, in a way that nobody else can pretend to be. So when you send out a certain message asserting that you want to pay someone a certain number of bitcoins, it comes along with a digital signature, which we know how to do because of these mathematical tools that cryptography has given us, so that anybody observing that transaction, whether it's the counterparty to that transaction or whether it's some other actor in the Bitcoin ecosystem, has the mathematical guarantee that you are the person who put that message on the network.
So, Arvin, before we turn to Bitcoins, I just want to make sure that this theoretical and practical overlap is clear. And so when we talk about cryptography and we talk about these structures, they are an aid to, if you will, privacy, which I think is at the core of allowing Bitcoin to operate. So, you know, change what I'm saying, but I guess the question becomes, what is the relationship in your mind between cryptography and what we understand to be privacy?
That's a great question. Cryptography actually relates to privacy in several different ways, technologically speaking, at least. One is the obvious way: you can encrypt a message, you can make sure that nobody except the intended recipient can read the message. Another relationship between cryptography and privacy is what we see in Bitcoin. It allows you to create sort of pseudonymous identities, so that somebody can know that a message came from you, except they don't know your legal identity. They only know a pseudonym associated with you. So that's another way, through anonymity of these identities, that cryptography relates to privacy. And perhaps a third way is what are called anonymity networks. It's anonymity again, but a different type of anonymity. And this relates to what is called Tor, which is an anonymity network that exists out there that allows you to browse the web without revealing your identity to the website you're visiting. It allows websites to put themselves out there without revealing to anybody what is the IP address they're operating from. And that's, of course, privacy-enhancing technology, but it's also a technology that people engaging in a variety of illegal activities have been able to make use of, so there's the good and the bad of it. Many people might know that by the term dark web. That's one use of anonymity technologies like Tor, but there are also a variety of others, enabling whistleblowers to speak privately, for example. So crypto, yeah, relates to privacy in several different ways: through encryption, through pseudonyms, and through these anonymity networks.
And, you know, what it shows, I mean, at least from a legal perspective, of course, when we use the word privacy or when we think about privacy, that word has a variety of meanings. Is it a bundle of rights? Is it a way of thinking about information? And and we see that, I think, reflected in computer science. So let's turn, and we're chatting with Professor Arvin Narayanan of Princeton on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Arvin, let's turn to the first of our primary topics here, which you've already alluded to, which is Bitcoin. You've already defined it a bit, and Ed Felton was on the show last year talking about Bitcoins. But for those who may not have heard that interview or who still aren't terribly familiar, what is Bitcoin, and what is its potential beyond the currency and trade aspects of it?
Absolutely. So Bitcoin is fundamentally a digital currency, and it heavily involves the use of cryptography. And so because of that, it's called a cryptocurrency. And Bitcoin is not the only cryptocurrency. There are others like it. Now, research on cryptocurrencies in the academic community goes back to the 80s, and some systems were proposed then. There were even one or two companies. DigiCash is one that comes to mind that tried to commercialize it. None of those really took root, but Bitcoin did. And now, one can ask, what is different about it? What's unique about it? What is its essence? What is it about it that's led to its success, at least so far? And perhaps to me, and this is a good way of explaining Bitcoin as well, perhaps its most important property, and arguably one that has led to its success, is that it's decentralized. And what that means is that there is no central government or bank or any sort of entity that controls the supply of Bitcoins and, you know, basically keeps records of who owns how much currency. This is in stark contrast to other ways of paying electronically, such as PayPal. PayPal and PayPal alone keeps track of how much money each person has in their PayPal account. And if all of PayPal's servers were to melt down in a fire or were to get hacked into, then all of those PayPal accounts are at risk. And similarly, a PayPal as a central entity has the ability to, for example, lock someone out of their PayPal account, let's say because they suspected fraudulent activity. Bitcoin, by its very nature, is a stark contrast to all of this. It is a decentralized system, so there is no such central authority. Instead, there are thousands of computers connected to the Bitcoin network on the internet, which collectively, no one of these machines is privileged in doing this, but collectively keep track of who owns how many Bitcoins. And when I say who owns how many Bitcoins, I mean which pseudonym owns how many Bitcoins. So there are no legal identities involved in the Bitcoin protocol. Instead, the network collectively keeps track of these pseudonymous identifiers together with how many Bitcoins they own and, crucially, all of the transactions that are made in the system. So it's a decentralized network which maintains a ledger that records all of the transactions that have in Bitcoins that have ever been made, and that ledger is what allows a digital currency to operate.
Now, Bitcoin, and this was something we had chatted about on Hearsay Culture with Ed, had a lot of stability issues, which to some degree have been addressed. But of course, then there's also players like Mt. Gox that come and go in the market. You've referred to Bitcoins and the potential of Bitcoin as moving us towards prediction markets that have this decentralized quality that you mentioned. What is a prediction market and what are its applications?
Sure, definitely. Let's talk about maybe markets for a second, then prediction markets as well. And so this is one of the research projects that I started with a bunch of people here at Princeton and elsewhere. And I'll connect it to the story that I told you earlier about how I got interested in Bitcoins.
Excellent.
For me personally, this started out with being fascinated by this process for doing research. And so for me, it all started with a tweet. I think it was only about 2 years ago. So I got into Bitcoin pretty late as a researcher. And I tweeted out saying, hey, is anybody interested in thinking about how you can use Bitcoin technology to build a decentralized prediction market? And again, I'm going to talk in a second about what those are. And I got a bunch of responses. I got a researcher who's a PhD candidate from the University of Maryland. I got someone who is now a professor at Concordia University in Canada, and a couple of others online. And I also talked here locally to Princeton people. And it was a fascinating experience for me because, even though I had gotten together with this bunch of academics, there were six of us, it was a geographically distributed team who had come together in a way that's very similar to how people come together in the non-academic Bitcoin community out there to talk about and develop ideas. So in that sense, the experience for me was a success in trying this new process. On the other hand, I also got a surprise. I found out that as we started doing this research, there were a lot of ideas and development and code coming from the community, but there were also, we started to gradually find, trickier questions that it seemed like would really benefit from someone thinking, sitting down and thinking about it carefully over a period of months. And as academics, we're really good at doing that. And so gradually we started to gravitate toward those types of questions in Bitcoin. And so we ended up with something that was very similar to the traditional academic process after all, even though the team had come together through this internet-enabled kind of very distributed kind of process. So it was really a hybrid between those two things, and it was a very illuminating experience for me. So we started thinking about markets. Bitcoin is a currency, so people had long been interested in the next step. So, okay, so you can make payments through Bitcoin, but can you actually have markets that are engineered in a technological sense using Bitcoin technology? And what that would mean is that items would be offered for sale using this similar sort of distributed system without any central entity controlling it. That's an idea that naturally comes out of Bitcoin, and people have been trying to address that, but it quickly became apparent that there were a lot of questions that required deeper thinking. For example, okay, sure, you can build a market, but there needs to be, if you're thinking about it in terms of a stock market, there needs to be an order book, and an order book is a fundamentally centralized entity. How do you decentralize that? What does that even mean? What would that kind of system look like? What would the economics of such a system, how would that differ from a traditional centralized market? And then we started looking at prediction markets, which are a fascinating and intricate type of market, both from a technology perspective and an economic perspective. And what that is let's say that you want to predict the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. Now, you can either listen to pundits on television pontificate endlessly, or you can do it a slightly more informed way through opinion polls and websites like 538 that do a lot of data crunching. Or there's actually a third option, which is you can create this market where people can make bets, can make wagers on who the winner is going to be in a year and a half, in such a way that those who had bet correctly would stand to collect on those bets and would win money, and those who had bet incorrectly would lose. And so this is the fundamental idea of a prediction market, and you can use it not just for the presidential election, for sports, really all kinds of things. And economists have been fascinated by this notion. They hold prediction markets in high regard, even though there's some dispute about it. And what I mean by in high regard is that economists believe it to be a very, very good way of eliciting the most accurate form of wisdom of the crowd, based on a number of people who all have a little bit of information and perspective on what the outcome of a certain event is going to be. So that's the fundamental idea of the prediction market.
And when we look at, when we think about these concepts, relating it back to the technology, I mean, you mentioned, you could look at pundits, and of course that would be one way to attempt to figure things out. But the potential here involving these prediction markets goes obviously well beyond those kinds of prognostications, but really into being able to forecast risk and understand where things are headed, not only in financial markets, but even potentially in areas like climate change. Now, my question really is, now that I framed it that way, am I overstating where this could head? In other words, are there limits, beyond imagination that you could perceive to how this kind of technology and these structures could be applied?
I think there is a huge potential. I don't think you've overstated it. Now, a lot of those applications haven't been proven or haven't had a chance to prove themselves yet, because the prediction markets that have existed so far have been, they haven't had a chance to grow as ambitious as a lot of people have wanted them to be. And that seems partly because they've always operated in a somewhat gray area of the law. InTrade, for example, was a well-known prediction market that I believe got shut down, but also because they haven't been a very popular mainstream sort of activity. And, you know, that's partly what we wanted to see in our research was whether decentralized prediction markets could have better properties than these centralized ones run by certain web services that have existed so far, like Betfair or Entrade. And by the way, you know, there are prediction markets operating now, and you can go to them and see that, for example, in the 2016 cycle that I mentioned, Hillary Clinton has a slightly better than even odds of coming out on top. Hmm. And that's a number that I personally put much more stock in than what people are saying on television. So even now, they do exist and are operating, but they haven't been used so far in very, very ambitious ways. What should our climate change policy be? Can we predict the probability of a terrorist attack even? People have talked about these things, but they haven't quite come into fruition. We seem to have a little bit of discomfort, sometimes bordering on paranoia as a society about these more ambitious uses of prediction markets. I'm not going to make sweeping statements about what we should or should not do with them, but certainly the technology for developing them, what are the different possible ways of incentivizing participants in a prediction market, how can a decentralized one based on Bitcoin technology help overcome some of the limitations of current prediction markets? We thought that there was a huge amount of room to research and develop that, and that's what we set about doing in this research collaboration that I mentioned.
So, Arvin, let me ask you one more question before we take a very quick break along those lines. And I certainly, respect the fact that you don't want to make normative statements with regard to what should or shouldn't be done. But let me ask you this question, because I think this is perhaps where the challenge lies. You know, if you think about using this technology for something like predicting terrorism or a criminal act, what we have called that, at least one way or one method, I should say, of making those predictions heretofore has been what's been known as profiling, which, as you know, is a highly controversial area, where groups like the ACLU have and people like Mike German there have said no. Profiling, aside from any other issues involving civil rights and liberties, it simply doesn't work. And then others in law enforcement and elsewhere, and even at the FBI, have said no, it does. Do you see, and I'm not asking you whether that's right or wrong, my question is this: do you think that there is a way to break through or change the discussion through using prediction markets that are built on computer science? In other words, the idea being that you can remove at some level these normative judgments and make or create a situation where one can make a defensible prediction that isn't altered or influenced by criteria that we as a society consider to be illegitimate. What do you make of that point? What do you make of that argument?
That's an interesting point, and certainly, the idea of using a sort of algorithmic system, which ultimately a prediction market is in a lot of ways, in order to minimize the role of human decision making, and also, therefore, distance oneself from possible ethical objections. Right. It's a very tempting notion, and that's certainly an argument that one can make. And I think, you know, prediction markets arrive at their conclusions, if you can call them conclusions, is very different from the way in which techniques like profiling arrive at their conclusions. The reason that prediction markets are considered to be effective is that, well, it's two things. One is it provides an incentive for people who might have access to some information that not a lot of others might have, for them to reveal that information to the system and capitalize financially on having had that information. An obvious example of this, and one that is illegal and not one that nobody is proposing that we use prediction markets for, is insider trading. That's one way of capitalizing on knowledge that you have and not a lot of others have, and profit in the markets in exchange for, you know, sort of revealing that information to the market. Prediction markets would apply this sort of logic for other events. if it were used for predicting climate change, for example, it's hard to argue that somebody has information about how climate change is going to evolve. You know, that is secret that should be protected, that they shouldn't divulge to the public, unlike the insider trading example. So the short answer to that question is prediction markets would allow you to sidestep some ethical concerns, but other ethical concerns would come into the picture. To use a very obvious example, if you were to use it to predict terrorist events, would that lead to the unintended consequence of incentivizing someone to carry out a terrorist attack in order to use that to profit in the prediction market? So all of these ethical issues exist. You know, they make some ethical tangles easier to address and others harder. So we don't have, you know, as researchers, we don't have too many normative prescriptions at the end of the day. But what I am convinced of is we should be talking about them more seriously, and to the extent that there are strong ethical objections, we should be working on innovative ways of keeping them in check, addressing them, having oversight, or even coming up with technical solutions that can help alleviate them, instead of more or less ignoring the power of prediction markets, which is how broadly from a policy perspective we've acted so far, and I think that is unfortunate.
And I want to pick that up right after our quick break here. We're chatting with Professor Arvind Narayanan of Princeton University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. I don't know, I don't know whether KZSU accepts bitcoins, Arvind. That might be something I could look into. But nonetheless, there are traditional ways to make a donation. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. I guess you could ask them if they'll take bitcoins. Or you could go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the discussion. So what you just said there, Arvind, is something I want to pick right up on before we turn to some of these blockchain issues that you've written about, and then move towards, in the latter part of our discussion, what crypto means in this context. So what you just alluded to, I think, is key. What is, in your experience, the not only the understanding of these kinds of technologies among policymakers, but then you alluded to it, and I have to follow up, this notion of avoidance, right, of not actually grappling with it. But let me ask the more charitable question, perhaps, which is, what is the understanding there, or is there one among policymakers who would have this within their jurisdiction?
The understanding among policymakers of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies started out with a lot of confusion, but within the last, 2 years or so, I think has improved dramatically. And this is, you know, partly because of efforts from within, governments to reach out and understand the technology, but also in large part because the Bitcoin community has been able to effectively organize itself in some ways in order to go out there proactively and educate policymakers. The Bitcoin Foundation was an organization that played a big role in this. They have less of a role now. There's a different organization now called Coin Center, which seems to be, from what I can tell, playing a leading role in educating policymakers on Bitcoin. And I think the place we are now, you know, obviously there's always room for improvement, but it's not a terrible place to be, I would say. There is, the proposed regulations, for example, that we've seen come out, and the main example that I'm thinking of is something called BitLicense from the New York State Department of Financial Services. You know, there's room for improvement there, but there are coming from a place where they do understand Bitcoin technology, and they're worried about the right things, and there's room for argument about what is the best way to address them, but I think there are concerns that they have that need to be addressed, and there are certainly some obvious examples. Now, if Bitcoin is a technology that works wonderfully across borders, and that's indeed one of the main advantages of it, as its proponents like to point out, then what does that mean for evading capital controls, for moving money across borders in a way that governments can't trace? That's obviously a worry, and so governments will want more oversight of that process, will want to regulate that. What does it mean for money laundering, for moving money into and out of the underground economy? What does it mean for anonymous online operations like Silk Road and many similar websites that have existed? And what Silk Road was, for viewers who may not have heard of it, was basically, one way to put it is, it was the eBay for illegal drugs until it got busted by law enforcement. And the reason that Bitcoin comes into it is that Silk Road accepted payments only in Bitcoins. And you can imagine why, because Bitcoin is a pseudonymous payment technology. I won't use the word anonymous. That is a standard of anonymity that, at least for computer scientists, Bitcoin doesn't quite meet. But it's the next best thing, which is pseudonymous. You operate with a pseudonym and not your real name. So there are a lot of these, I think, legitimate concerns around Bitcoin and what it can be used for. And again, there's always room for improvement in how well policymakers and regulators understand the issues. But I'm not too unhappy with where things are right now.
So, Arvind, let's talked about some of these concerns. One of the more optimistic and perhaps forward-thinking views on this, and something you've written about, is that what is known as the blockchain will replace other intermediaries that operate within spheres that Bitcoin operates in. What is the blockchain, and what is that line of reasoning?
Sure. So the blockchain is the, you could call it the underlying technological magic of Bitcoin. It is this public ledger that allows this digital currency to operate. It's the public ledger that records for all eternity who or which pseudonyms have made which transactions with which other pseudonyms. And the realization that has led to a lot of excitement in the Bitcoin community, among venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, among tech startups, is that now that this ledger exists, now that this blockchain exists, you can use it for recording other things, and not just things related to transfers of currency. One obvious example is that you can use it to record transfers of stock, for example, instead of currency. The reason that people consider this to be an effective way of doing things is that the blockchain is considered highly secure, and the security, and this is another technical innovation of Bitcoin, the security is fundamentally linked to the operation of Bitcoin miners, which is another thing that some viewers may have heard of, but not everyone. So miners are these people who buy this sort of very expensive Bitcoin mining equipment, and this mining equipment is churning all day, every second, computing some time-consuming mathematical operations at the rate of billions and billions per second. And so Bitcoin's technical innovation has been linking the security of the blockchain to this mining process that's happening and is burning somewhere in the vicinity that we estimate of 100 to 300 megawatts of electricity. So, you know, a lot of electricity, a lot of hardware is dedicated purely to maintaining the security of the blockchain, to make sure that anything that's put on there cannot be corrupted by an adversary, cannot be modified, cannot be suppressed, cannot be deleted. And that's what ensures the security of your money, fundamentally, your currency. But it also could ensure the security of these other things that you care to put on the blockchain, such as stock transfers. And some people have even gone so far as to suggest it could represent transfers of property, that in the future we would sell anything from, a little item that you might sell on Craigslist to even a house by, in fact, putting messages onto the Bitcoin blockchain that represents the transfer of property.
So we're chatting with Professor Arvind Narayanan of Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Arvind, we've entered now what I call the unfair portion of the show, and this is the portion of the show where I start asking you questions that you may not have time to adequately answer in the time we have left, but then I ask them anyway, as any good radio host would. At the same time that we have, you know, these possibilities, you know, there is, and to pivot a little bit in our last, I'd say, about 15 minutes, there is some concern that, as we alluded to earlier, that cryptography is not as, and within that, right, what Bitcoin is capable of doing, is not as great of a privacy-enhancing tool as we had thought. What do you make of that point? In other words, what are the limitations of cryptography, both in enhancing privacy and also in de-anonymizing and really removing those intermediaries from the technological sphere?
Right. This is a point that I like to emphasize that I think hasn't been fully understood, the limitations of, you know, what cryptography can and cannot do. In the example of the blockchain, the way I like to think about it is, if you're thinking about doing transfers of property, let's say cars, through the blockchain, then it's not solving any of the hard problems associated with selling cars. It's solving all of the easy problems that we already know how to solve. And what I mean by that is, the hard problem in selling cars is not so much recording who has the ownership, but instead figuring out what to do when a car gets stolen. Because, you know, this technical notion of possession, who has the key or who's behind the steering wheel, does not translate directly to legal ownership. If a car is stolen, we'd like to get it back to its owner, even though it's temporarily under the possession of somebody else. And that's one of the hard problems with selling cars. Another hard problem with selling cars is, if you're selling a used car, do both parties correctly understand what that car represents? Or is a lemon car being sold, and how do you prevent that kind of unfair transaction? Representing property through the blockchain and selling property in that manner, in fact, makes all of these problems vastly harder, because what you're trying to do is remove human judgment from that process, remove human intermediaries. And not just human intermediaries, we're talking about the legal and social and regulatory institutions and economic intermediaries that have evolved over centuries. And so if you want to remove those and replace those with an automated process that's going to determine in a very technological fashion who has ownership of a car at any given moment, I think you've failed to solve the hard problems and only made them harder. So that's one way in which I'm a little bit skeptical of proposed applications of crypto. Another way is that people, especially in the academic cryptographic community, are fond of coming up with very fancy cryptographic protocols through which, instead of the way that the cloud is architected today, all of your data would reside on your own devices, and the cloud would somehow still compute on them by, you know, having your device perform some cryptographic operations, uploading encrypted data out there. The cloud would operate on the encrypted data, and then it only starts to get more complicated and crazy from there. I couldn't even faithfully describe it, given that we're running short of time. But, you know, some of the problems that I see with that whole process are both technical and economic in nature. From a technical perspective, the crypto that's being proposed for some of these problems is just way too complex for anybody to implement and be reasonably sure that it's bug-free. In fact, a lot of the crypto that we're using now is very, very standard stuff that was invented back in the 70s and 80s, and even a lot of the crypto that's been invented since then, we're even struggling to see what it's useful for. And besides, there are also economic problems. You know, the cloud fundamentally wants your data. A lot of these companies, their business models and their funding are premised on having access to your data and finding secondary uses for it. So in a way, we seem to be trying to solve complex social, legal, economic problems using technical quick fixes, and I don't think the problem is as easy as that.
you know, the way that this that these issues play out, particularly today, is so heavily focused, at least within the intellectual property and information policy world, around cybersecurity and the risks associated with hackers who grab commercial information or information that's valuable from a national security standpoint. In an essay that you wrote recently, you distinguished between crypto for security and crypto for privacy. So as we parse these words, we can now draw the distinction between security and privacy. What is that distinction, and how should it be understood as we think about these technologies?
There's a little bit of a you know it when you see it sort of flavor to that distinction in my mind. So let me just give you a quick example. To me, a lot of it boils down to you know, how the economic incentives are aligned and where they reside and so on. Now, when you're buying something online and you want to make sure that the website encrypts your credit card number when you type it into your browser and it's being sent to the website, to me, that's crypto for security. It's not so much the privacy, quote unquote, of your credit card number that you're worried about. You're not going to be embarrassed if your credit card number is leaked to hackers, but instead, what's at stake is your security, and you know, in particular, your financial security. So in this kind of example, everybody's incentives are aligned. You want to protect your credit card number. The website wants to protect your credit card number. On the other hand, there are a lot of people suggesting that, you know, we should upload encrypted data to Facebook, or Facebook should encrypt our data, and these service providers should not even see our data in the first place, and that's really the only way to be safe from surveillance and you know, targeted advertising and a variety of other things. To me, that falls more into the crypto for privacy category. The economic incentives are emphatically not aligned. Facebook is in the business of you know, getting your data. The reason they provide you any services at all is as an excuse for them to get your data. That's the fundamental thing they care about. So trying to change that economic model, I think, has a little bit of a flavor of tilting at windmills. I think there are going to be some small victories there. End-to-end encryption of email is, I think, one fight that's worth fighting. And what that means is your email is encrypted all the way from your computer to the recipient's computer. And when it passes through Gmail or Hotmail or whatever, it's still encrypted and the service provider can't see your email. So that's an example of, I think, what I would call a small victory for crypto for privacy that is worth at least fighting for if it happens. And that's only because of the heightened privacy awareness because of Snowden and so on. 2 years ago, these things were not even on the table. So that's kind of how I would draw the distinction. I think trying to get companies to protect your credit card number, prevent your health data from leaking to hackers, protect your cloud photos, again, from being leaked to the public, has recently happened with the Apple hack and, you know, the Sony hack. These are all things that are crypto for security that are worth. I think these are winnable battles in the long run, but trying to get Facebook to not have access to your data, I don't think that's quite a feasible goal to achieve.
We're chatting with Professor Arvind Narayanan on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Arvind, we have about 6 minutes left, 6 or 7 minutes. You know, all of this conversation, you know, leads back to this original question that we've been dealing with, and by we, I mean really society. You've just alluded to it with regard to information that Snowden made public, which is, if we're not going to use cryptography, then what is, or is there, a technological answer to this broad issue of surveillance, both commercial and really non-commercial? I mentioned in my introduction your involvement in leading the Web Transparency and Accountability Project. Perhaps now, in our waning minutes, you could talk a little bit about that project and what that means in this broader policy discussion that we've been having.
For sure. And I do think crypto has a lot of roles to play here. It's just not the answer to all of our privacy concerns. And I think one excellent complement to protecting our data, to encrypting our data, is to at least make sure that we can address the information asymmetry, where, and what I mean by information asymmetry is a situation where these service providers, especially commercial ones, have access to our data, know what we're up to, but we don't know what their policies are, what they're using that data for. So we don't even have a way to make informed judgments about which service provider I want to interact with, whether or not I'm comfortable sharing my data in a certain situation or not. And so that's one of the information asymmetry issues that we're trying to address, my research group here at Princeton, in a commercial setting. There are other people trying to do it in a government setting. That's also equally important work. But we focus on the commercial setting, the people who are tracking you online, especially the targeted advertising industry. And so we try to bring a transparency to that whole ecosystem. And the way we've been doing it is a very technological approach, and it's a quite an interesting approach that has caught on recently in the last couple of years in the computer science research community, which is to program bots, automated agents, with automated web browsers, to go and constantly browse the web, to go out there day and night, to visit a lot of websites, make searches, interact on these websites to a certain degree. And these browsers are, I'll use a technical term here, instrumented. And what instrumented means is that these browsers are modified to record a ton of data about what the websites are doing in terms of observing the user. So that's the way in which we bring transparency. We record a lot of that data, and then we as researchers analyze it and use that to see what's going on. And I'll just mention one of our successes recently. There is a technique called canvas fingerprinting, which is a pretty sneaky technique through which a website draws a hidden image on your screen. You can't see it, but you know it's going to be there on your screen when you visit a website. And what they're doing that for is that the precise way in which that image is drawn on the screen serves as a fingerprint of your device, so that they can know whenever you come back to the site that it's you, the same person who visited all of those times in the past, even if you've not chosen to build to divulge your identity to them. And so they can build up a profile of your web browsing, not just on one site, but across a variety of sites,
wow.
Basically a dossier of your browsing history.
Amazing.
Now, this technique was so sneaky that it took a research paper in 2012 to even propose this technique. It was pretty complex. And it turned out that a mere 18 months or so after that paper came out, it had been widely deployed in our measurement over 5,500 websites. Nobody even knew for sure it was going on at all on any site, but we found that it was so widely deployed. And that's the tragedy of it. That's the level of information asymmetry. It meant that, you know, most listeners up until the point we did the study had been, quote-unquote, canvas fingerprinted on a daily basis, and yet nobody had any evidence that it was even happening. And we're talking about the public web that we all go to every day. And it took a research study to find this out. So that's the kind of research that we're doing, bringing transparency to online tracking practices, online data use practices. Once your data is collected, where is it going? What is it being used for? And the research that we do has been having an impact. The main company that we found that was doing this, once we published our study and the press wrote about it, you know, there was a lot of backlash. There were a lot of angry tweets and so on. So they decided to end the practice. And we found that when, you know, when companies understand that there is scrutiny, then they sort of police themselves and don't step too far into the direction of commercial surveillance. But that oversight is essential, and academics are, I think, are in a very good position to do that. There are not a lot of people with the incentive to act as this oversight mechanism. So we've enjoyed being in that role and collaborating with others. And I think, you know, industry self-regulation has a role as well. But as academics, we see ourselves as innovating and leading the charge in developing the technology that's going to create this external oversight of commercial surveillance.
You know, what you just pointed out, Arvind, and I saw a talk related to this at CITP involving the research that that you and your colleagues are doing to just figure out the technology itself, as you alluded to, putting aside the question of how we should address it. Understanding what the technology is doing is so complex that and there are barriers to even doing that work. One of the interesting things that I had noticed was literally that intellectual property law can serve as a barrier to doing the research, particularly since, as you've alluded to, the commercial entities doing this work are not going to be very forthcoming in telling you that they're doing it, much less how. And the law can actually step in to prevent that kind of research on a trade secret side and copyright side and the like. That is a topic which is so interesting, so complex, that I'm not putting you on the spot, Arvin, but certainly I would welcome you back on the show to focus, and we could easily do an hour just on what you do with the WebTap project. Very quickly, though, for those that want to learn more about you and your work, you have randomwalker.info, Freedom the Tinker, CITP's website. Anything else or any other places you would point my listeners to learn more about the issues that we talked about today?
Well, I'm on Twitter as well, and you can follow the links from my webpage, and you know, you can engage me in conversation there, and I often tweet things that are both at the boundary of research but also accessible to the general public to learn more about these issues, and you know, you can comment on the Freedom to Tinker blog. I certainly welcome a conversation. It was great being on the show, Dave.
Arvin, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. It's a great work. It's been a pleasure getting to know you this year at Prince. I look forward to continuing working with you and, again, inviting you back on the show. Thanks for taking the time today.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
I'm happy to mention a few guests coming up in the remaining few weeks on Hearsay Culture's schedule. This show is the third to last, as far as I can tell. Coming up will be Jacob Silverman, author of Terms of Service, Social Media, and the Price of Constant Connection. And rounding out this quarter will be Professor Jason Arnold of Virginia Commonwealth University, author of Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, The Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Laws. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture this quarter. You can pick up the show 4 p.m. Pacific Time on Wednesdays on KZSFM Stanford, which you can stream live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet and Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to the iTunes page, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 230 plus previous shows and the upcoming schedule. As I always do, I will not be airing new shows during the interim period on KZSU's schedule, which runs from about mid-June through the beginning of July, but then you can look for new guests coming up for the summer, and I'll talk more about them in the coming few weeks. Meanwhile, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com or by going to the contact form at hearsayculture.com and proving that you're not a robot, or you're not, for that matter, a Bitcoin, or for that matter, you're not an other kind of algorithm that I would love to hear from, but really prefer, at least because it's a radio show, to hear from human beings. Thank you for listening today to the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.